So after the talk last week, I was actually intending to do a completely different topic this week, but the discussion was really rich, and that was a Sunday night, and I went home, and the next morning I woke up, and I was like, oh, I missed a whole huge part of this. And so that's where this talk came out of. And it's called Anatta Part Two, Joy Shines Through. So last week we talked about the basics of anatta and what it means and its importance in the Buddhist teachings. And just a very brief recap. One way to put anatta, the concept of anatta, which directly translated means not self or lack of self or unself, perhaps. One way to put it is that it's empty of a permanent, independent, and satisfactory self. Another way to put it, which I perhaps favor, I don't know, is just that nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. And that's a very useful way to think of it. Doesn't mean that we don't exist. Doesn't mean that we don't have a zip code or can't be located on a GPS, but it means that that's not the whole story, and that's not the place where we should invest our identity, because that's going to bring suffering. Now, I want to do a little sidebar here. And by the way, these notes are already up on the website, so they're pretty complete. So I want to do a sidebar here around words and concepts, because Elizabeth talked about that a little bit last week, and I wanted to say just a little bit more about that. For most of us, the Dharma is new territory. Relatively speaking, it's new territory. And so it's helpful to have a map of what's out there or what's in there as we begin to explore this new territory. And that gives us an inkling of even what might be possible in practice. So I know when I first started practicing, teachers would say stuff, and I'd be like, "What the hell does that mean?" But then as I started to learn the framework of the teachings, it really was like a very lovely roadmap. And so you get an inkling of what's possible, and then as you practice, the words and concepts become signposts for where you've been, so you can interpret it, and for where you are on the path. And Elizabeth was completely right last week that in the end, the concepts aren't what matters. What matters is our experience of freedom. And that's really what we're practicing for, is to have that experience in more and more fully fleshed out ways to have the experience of freedom. So words and concepts help us recognize what we're doing in practice, help us realize what we've accomplished, but they're best used as tools and not as boundaries. Okay? So they're kind of like starting points, you know. And the difference between the words and the concepts and the experience is much like the difference between a map and the actual driving on the road. Huge difference. But the map is cool. I love maps. So tonight I really wanted to talk about what the implications are of anatta. What it means for us. Why this is really important, and also why it's really cool and beautiful. I may have said this last week, but people take different viewpoints to the Dharma depending on their personal nature and what have you, personality characteristics. And I've said that my teacher Wes Nisker always says that learning the truth of suffering was for him such a huge relief. That was really, that let him understand that suffering didn't mean that there was something wrong in the world, but that it was really part of the unsigned contract we have with life, right? The fine print, as he puts it. For me, I feel that way about anatta. It's a huge relief to me to understand that truth, even to the extent that I do understand it. So one of the big implications of practicing in this way is that we get the relief of letting go of identifying with impermanent and unsatisfactory things like the body. Right? That there's no need to be anybody in particular. That there's no need to uphold a certain persona. And this is in part why silent retreats are so pleasant and so valuable, so beneficial. And it's why people cling to the silence at the end of the retreat. Because, you know, you may go in and you may be a little fearful of being silent, but then you realize that you just get to be with your own crap inside your own head. You're not trying to uphold or your own nice stuff inside your own head, too. Cuts both ways. But you don't have to put your energy into upholding this social persona anymore. And it frees up huge resources so you can really dive in deep into practice. Mm-hmm. So there's also this sense of ease that comes in any moment that we're able to touch into not clinging in that way. There's this great ease that comes up of being just here and just now with not so much of an agenda that we have to fulfill or push. There's a sense of spaciousness that comes as we have the space to just be without the boundaries and the limitations of self. And in that space, joy manifests naturally, because that's part of the nature of who we are when the distortions of selfing are out of the way. Mm-hmm. So here's a quote from Dogen, a very famous Zen master from the 1200s. To study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. Now, most people stop there, but the quote goes on. To be enlightened by all things is to be free from attachment to the body and mind of oneself and of others. It means wiping out even attachment to enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Wiping out attachment to enlightenment, we must enter actual society. You know, which is, there was another famous Zen story where a guy is carrying a load of firewood up the mountain. And I have to remember how this goes now. A guy is carrying a load of firewood down the mountain. And another guy's going up the mountain. And the guy going up the mountain is trying to meet the guy coming down the mountain to ask him questions, because the guy coming down the mountain is a master. And so guy going up the mountain says, okay, what is the nature of enlightenment? And the guy carrying the big bunch of sticks lets them go, and they drop on the mountainside. And so the monk who asked him the question is immediately enlightened, and he sees that it's just this vast letting go, right? And so he stands there for a minute, and he's completely, you know, in the moment of being enlightened. And then he can talk again, and he looks at this teacher and he says, well, now what? And the teacher reaches down and picks up all the pieces of firewood and keeps walking down the mountain. So there's this, you know, vast freedom and liberation, and then we apply ourselves to society, to life, to living with that new nature, if you will. To study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. To be enlightened by all things is to be free from attachment to the body and mind of oneself and of others. It means wiping out even attachment to enlightenment. Wiping out attachment to enlightenment, we must enter actual society. Okay. So, last weekend, I had the pleasure and opportunity to be down in Monterey. It was the 39th anniversary of my husband's and my marriage. And we decided to celebrate it down in Monterey, and we went whale watching down there. Mm-hmm. And you may have all heard the news. There are humpback whales all over Monterey Bay right now, mm-hmm. Which is just amazing. And we went out on this four-hour whale watch out of Moss Landing, which I highly recommend. You should do it now in the next few weeks because they'll be there probably until the latter part of October. When they migrate, but this particular group of whales does not migrate to Hawaii. They migrate to Mexico, so they go down to like around, I think you said Puerto Vallarta, hang out for the winter, come back up. But they're now starting to stay in Monterey Bay from like March or April through the early fall, and that's because there's this amazing rich upwelling of waters, and it's also because apparently, the humpback whale population has recovered so much in recent years that they're now exploiting new habitats where they probably were in the past, but they're filling up their habitats again. You know, and so there are these huge, amazing creatures out there, and we saw probably 70 whales in 4 hours. It was unbelievable. Yeah.
Well, I was on South Monterey on the Big Sur coast, south of Lucia, and we saw a pod of about 15 humpbacks, and we were up about 1,000 feet, and they were circling this school of fish, and they were just feeding, and they were breaching, and birds all around, and they looked small from the distance we were seeing, but they were spouts shooting everywhere. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It is, you know, and so, I mean, you just get a sense for the vastness of life, and you know, that there's these amazing creatures out there. They're a dynamic part of the food chain. They're embedded in the whole web of life on Earth, just as we are. I heard this thing on NPR several months ago about some people doing research on whales, and I can't remember which type, but this person was calling whales engineers of their ecosystem. Because whale poop is such a valuable source of nutrients for all the microbiota in a particular ecosystem, that when there are whales in a place, it enriches, you know, that ocean ecosystem tremendously. So seeing all these whales, you know, knowing at least sensing that had a lot of positive ramifications for the environment, at least in Monterey Bay as it is now. It was just a source of joy and well-being. It was like being in an old-growth redwood forest, sort of. And I don't know if any of you have ever been in an old-growth forest, but it's really different. And it feels, it's just like there's this richness to it that's kind of indescribable.
Isn't your woods an old-growth redwood?
No.
It's not?
No.
Oh.
No, it's second growth.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it was logged. Oh. Yeah. The only place that I've ever been in true old growth was up in Jedediah Smith State Park, across the river from where the campground is. There's a real easily accessible swath of old growth forest, and it just feels really different than Muir Woods. And it struck me because I've always loved Muir Woods, and Muir Woods is fantastic. Yeah. And Muir Woods is very healthy. But old growth is a different order of being.
Wow, that's really good to know.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So anyway.
I'd like to go there. I'd like to go to that place.
Yeah. Jedediah Smith State Park.
Yeah.
It's a really nice state park. So some of my reflections, I was reflecting on, you know, just life and whales, and it was amazing. And then I was reflecting on the marriage of my husband and I, and the fact that our marriage is a direct cause of our daughter to be here, and therefore our marriage is a direct cause of our grandson to be here, who's now 18 months old, tearing up the world. And then I was like, okay, but wait, you know, Doug and I are the proximate causes of Lindsay for sure, but Doug and I are only four of the grandparently causes of D. There's two other grandparents in that mix. And then, you know, it was like,
right.
You know, the mind just like went back out to this whole stream of ever-widening ancestors. And seeing that that my little grandson, just like each of us, is embedded in this amazing tapestry. We are like a little thread in a tapestry of humanity that goes back forever and goes forward for who knows how long, hopefully a long time. But we're interdependent, you know, that we're not separate, as Kathleen was alluding to earlier. And then one more reflection. So in this one place in Monterey Bay, well, we were, you know, on Kennery Row a lot, and there's a little beach there, and they have some historic information about the canning industry back in the 30s, which, you know, was huge in Monterey. And at the height of the canning industry, they were processing 200,000 tons of fish per year. So that's 400 million pounds of fish per year. And sardines, you know, are, I don't know, like, let's say there's three of them to a pound. They're, you know, five-ounce little guys or something. So that was, so just rough figures, that's 1 billion fish per year that were processed just in Monterey and just one species, basically. So again, that just gives you the a little window into the vast number of beings that there are in the world. You know, there's now 7 billion people on the planet. You know, we're pretty tiny in that whole mass, right? So we're part of that incredible vastness. The, you know, I'm spacing on John. What John was saying earlier about seeing these whales feeding on these schools of fish. We were seeing that too from the whale watching boat, and it was so predictable because there were a couple hundred seals out there in the area where we were whale watching, and the seals would disappear for 5 minutes, and then they would come up, and in one particular area of water, probably not much bigger than this room, maybe a little bigger, maybe the size of this building, there would be like 200 seals, and they would just be boiling in the water, just diving. And it was because all these fish were there. And then the whales would show up, and there were like 6 whales in this particular group. What they were doing, the guy on the boat was explaining to us, is they're herding the fish. They take their breath, they go down deep, and they start blowing bubbles in a circle around an area where there are fish, and then they slowly move them up to the surface. And when the fish get close to the surface, then the seals move in and start doing their thing. And then it was like predictable that 20 or 30 seconds later, the whales would pop up, and they'd start swooping through and catching all these, you know, these vast numbers of beings. It was quite amazing. Quite amazing. And then at one point, this one whale was slapping his fin. Their fins are 15 feet long, these guys. The humpbacks are 50 feet long. And so their big pectoral fins are 15 feet long, and they're white. And they come up, and this guy was like slapping the water. I think he was just happy being so well fed. I don't know. Maybe he was getting the barnacles off. Who knows? But anyway, it was amazing. So we are part of this amazing web of life, this intricacy and vastness, which made me think of another one of my favorite quotes, which says that wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. Between the two, my life flows. That's Nisargadatta, an Indian sage who was also a teacher to many of the Western Vipassana teachers. Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. And between the two, my life flows. So why do nature and beauty of all kinds please us so much? What's your favorite experience of nature? Or one that really sticks out for you?
I like being up high.
Being up high.
And seeing just the open expansiveness, whether it's like the ocean, just forever, or I was just camping for the weekend up north from here. We always hike up to some high point.
Hike up to some high
just
point.
Love to see, like, Yeah, because I feel I do. I think I get my perception or whatever just gets too closed. My mind closes down for some reason. But when I get somewhere, like it just expands, and I just feel like, oh yeah,
yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. Okay, a few others, Ron.
I think for me it was in July this year when I was at Glacier National Park, and surrounded was an understatement because just all around me was nature as it has always been, and it was comforting knowing that nature will be around once we're gone. And I think that, for me, that was a big takeaway because a lot of us, when we're fighting the naysayers of climate change, are like, we need to save nature. And I'm like, no, we don't. We need to save ourselves.
That's right. Nature will take care of itself. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Mindy?
I love that feeling of being in the ocean, especially underwater, scuba diving. That feeling of just being held by the water, being held by the ocean, and just being a part of everything, and looking up, like flipping over and just looking up and watching the waves roll over and seeing the sky and the birds and just sort of being some small part of everything.
Beautiful. Yeah. Barbara?
I think just looking up at the sky at night when the moon is full and it's clear. Or even under any different circumstances, there are so many different experiences of moonlight and clouds and hiding in clouds and different shades of cloud cover and night sky.
Night sky, yeah, absolutely.
I think for me, just, you know, like when I hike and I go hiking, do a lot of hiking in the mountains, and the birds, I love birds. I love just hearing the nature, no sounds, no... the feeling I get is peacefulness for sure, but it's something way bigger than me, and I just feel like...
Thank you. Something way bigger than you. Yeah.
There's something very assuring and very peaceful about that.
Okay. So why do nature and all kinds of beauty please us so much? You think of the Grand Canyon or Yosemite or a beautiful sunset at the beach or a waterfall or a snow-capped peak beyond a flower-filled meadow or on and on and on and on. A compelling experience in nature causes us to lose ourselves, right? Points to something bigger than ourselves, takes us out of ourselves. And beauty, likewise, beauty is beauty, of course, and has its own value. But part of its allure also is that it points to anatta, just as nature does. It points to anatta. I was listening to this amazing violin album I just got a few weeks ago. And, you know, when I'm listening to some piece of music like that, I'm sure you've all experienced this, it feels like I'm transported somewhere else. You know, that we use words like transcendent or, you know, it takes us beyond ourselves. So these experiences of nature and beauty point directly to anatta. They take us to that place. You were saying it, you know, it feels so good. You know, it's that relief. It's that relief. Because when that happens, we're completely absorbed in the moment. And we're no longer self-identified. So there's nothing in that moment that's being clung to, right? And this wild kind of joy erupts spontaneously. So here's another wonderful passage. This is about a Zen Buddhist nun named Tejitsu. She was an 18th century abbess of a Zen Buddhist nunnery near Eheiji, Japan. And this is the account of her moment of awakening. She saw that all phenomena arose, abided, and fell away. She saw that knowing this in itself arose, abided, and fell away. Then she knew there was nothing more than this. No ground, nothing to lean on stronger than the cane she held, nothing to lean upon at all, and no one leaning. And she opened the clenched fist in her mind and let go, and fell into the midst of everything. Nothing to lean upon at all, and no one leaning. And she opened the clenched fist in her mind and let go, and fell into the midst of everything. So in those moments when we can let go of identifying with anything, we get it all back. Right? We fall into the midst of everything. We're fully present in the world. We return and enter actual society. So, you know, one of the things that's so great about anatta is it lets us be fully alive. You know, emptiness is another word for anatta, and emptiness lets us see what's true. There's no obscuration anymore. So when we're in the state of not clinging to anything to be identified with, there's clarity that's caused by that. So clarity is caused by emptiness, because if we're not caught up in our opinions, our judgments, our stories of who we are and how we need to defend that, we can see much more clearly what's happening right now. So clarity is caused by emptiness in many ways, but clarity also implies emptiness. So at a moment when we're seeing clearly, if we reflect, we probably will notice that we're not clinging to much. It's usually a time when our sense of self is pretty muted, pretty absent. Now, another Zen master, and I meant to look up who actually said this, but I didn't, so I apologize, said, "The whole of practice is an appropriate response." And really, emptiness or anatta is what allows an appropriate response. Because there's nothing to block seeing what is true in any given situation and then responding appropriately. Okay, just a couple more things here. Anatta is not passivity. So recently, I had an interesting patient at work. Many of you know I am a speech pathologist and I work in a long-term care facility for 8 more weeks. Wow. Then I will be retired. But I recently had a patient who was a bit of a curmudgeon. A bit of a curmudgeon. We have a young occupational therapist, and she had just come out of his room, and he had told her to, what had he told her? He had said, "Get out of here, you little shit." So then I went in and tried to engage with him. And he said to me, I didn't say who I was. I just stood there and I watched him eating his lunch because I was trying to assess his swallowing. And then I said a couple of things to him. And then he looked at me and he said, "Are you a doctor?" And I went, "No, I'm a speech pathologist." And I said, "Speech therapist." And he said something like, "There are so many of you useless people in the world."
Right
here. At which point, and I was expecting something like this, having heard the tale of the poor OT who had gone before.
So, like his speech was
okay. Speech was fine. No, nothing wrong with his speech, exactly, yeah. So I just looked at him and I said, "So tell me, is verbal abuse a long-standing pattern of yours, or is this something new?" And he was like, you know. But it completely changed his attitude, and it allowed me to actually get somewhere with him just by acknowledging what was true. I didn't say it in a mean way, but, you know, I think. But, yeah, I was just saying what was going on, right? He was being verbally abusive to everybody. I had clarity.
What was his answer, by the way?
He didn't say anything.
He didn't say it's a long-standing pattern.
No, he didn't. He just didn't say anything. Yeah. And then I resumed. I asked him about how his swallowing and chewing were going on. In the meantime, he was having some difficulties. So you know, it allowed there to be a positive interaction. You know.
So that's all. Some people would say that he was the Buddha coming to you in a way that to get your attention.
Yeah. He had my attention, and you know, I was trying to meet force with force.
You brought him to reality.
In a way,
you disarmed
him.
He lost it, and then he was able to interact with you by you calling it what it was.
Yeah, thank you. I knew there was something in there.
Without judgment.
Without judgment, right.
No,
yeah.
No sarcasm.
Right, yeah, it was just like, wow, here's verbal abuse. How's that working out for you?
His long-term pattern is this new.
Level of dementia, too. I'm wondering if this is something brand new.
That was a whole different part of the assessment. So anatta really allows us to be seamlessly in touch with life as it's happening around us, and allows us to have the freedom to dance with it in a more or less effortless way when we're in that space. Right? And in that space, there's nothing to block the joy of being alive. What I was going to say about that interaction with the patient was I didn't take it personally, because I knew if I took it personally, it was game over. Right,
exactly.
Game over. Yeah.
You would have responded with a little attitude, maybe, or not.
But I didn't take it personally, but I did want to meet force with force in some, and it was all intuitive. I mean, I didn't think about this. I didn't analyze it at the moment,
Because you were present.
So I wanted to just say a couple things about how anatta unfolds in our practice. I think the first thing that usually happens is that we touch it. We touch into it in meditation. And usually, when we touch into it in meditation, the first time it's pretty mind-stopping. It's kind of like, oh my God. Although it can be mind-stopping in a nice way too. Mm-hmm. But, you may feel like the trap door just kind of opening underneath, and it's like, oh my God, now what? But then, once it happens, we start to touch into it again and again. And each experience of anatta can come garbed in its own images and its own circumstance. And so they're not necessarily going to be the same ever two times in a row, or they might be. But there's one flavor of anatta. It has one flavor, and that is, it has this flavor of previously unimaginable freedom and ease. It has a flavor of love or compassion, and a sense of timelessness. There's just this moment there where you're seeing what's true, and you're no longer bound by time. So that's kind of the first thing that happens, is we touch into it in meditation. Then the second thing is we start to integrate it a little bit into our daily lives and see glimmers of it here and there in daily life. And we remember times when we've experienced anatta naturally and spontaneously, like being on the top of a very high place or being suspended in the ocean or being surrounded by nature and feeling completely embedded in it and feeling that it's bigger than me. It's way bigger than me. So we remember times that we've experienced it naturally and spontaneously, and we begin to experience it fully in daily life as well as on the cushion. And then the third thing is we practice to live there more and more. So our practice starts to support and cause the conditions for us to experience it more. And then it also allows us, of course, to see the places where we're still clinging, because, once you start to experience that kind of freedom, it's like, oh, the other stuff, really suffers by comparison, to put it very calmly and mildly. So we see that where we cling to some identity or other, and we start to loosen those places as well. In my own practice lately, I've been seeing in more and more stark relief the judgments when they come up in my mind. Seeing the residual conditioning around race that I have, and the many other ways that I'm conditioned to see myself as either better than or less than others. So what I've let my practice be is to allow those mind states to be there, to really see them for what they are, and to not take that additional step of saying, this is who I am and this is who I'm going to be all my life. So I see it, I feel the suffering around it, and I don't say, this is who I am. I say, oh, this is what's here. And I see the causes and conditions that have brought it to be. And then I can work on those areas and start to loosen those causes and conditions and get, hopefully, to a place where they don't come up so much anymore. So there's this sense of being able to separate out the conditioning that I have as a person who has grown up in this body, in this society, in these life circumstances, to separate out that conditioning that I still need to change and work with, to separate that from the tendency to grab onto those negative mind states and make them who I am. So we don't need to do that. That's that second dart, that extra layer of suffering. And then, you know, just seeing the natural manifestations of anatta in nature and in beauty, in poetry, in loving kindness practice, and in all things, really. And allowing that to be seen and felt as well, so not blocking that wild or that gentle eruption of joy that comes. So I wanted to read at least one more poem by Hafiz. And, you know, Hafiz is perhaps, one of the poets whose work points most consistently toward anatta. Mm-hmm. Clearly, Alison Luderman does too, and many other poets do. Mary Oliver comes to mind. But Hafiz, man, he's my go-to guy. So, there's two more here. One is, I hold the lion's paw. This one is also about dancing. I hold the lion's paw whenever I dance. I know the ecstasy of the falcon's wings when they make love against the sky. And the sun and moon will sometimes argue over who will tuck me in at night. If you think I am having more fun than anyone on this planet, you are absolutely correct. But Hafiz is willing to share all his secrets about how to befriend God. Indeed, dear ones, Hafiz is so very willing to share all his secrets about how to know the beautiful one. I hold the lion's paw whenever I dance. I know the ecstasy of your heart's wings when they make love against the sky. And the sun and moon will someday argue over who will tuck you in at night. Okay, one more. One of my all-time faves. Throw me on a scale, and I've probably read this here before, so, but it's just awesome, especially the first line. Today, love has completely gutted me. I am lying in the market like a filleted grouper. Speechless. Every desire and sinew absolutely silent, but I am still so fresh. Everything is now the same to me. Listen, the touch of a beautiful woman as she lifts me near, drawing my scent into her body. She thinks about taking me home. The touch of a wondrous fly, drinking my vital fluids through a strange-shaped flute. the sun laying its radiant gaze against my cheek. Human voices and the breeze from a passing horse's tail all send miraculous currents into my world. God's beauty has split me wide open. Throw Hafiz on a scale. Wrap me in cloth. Bring me home. Lift a piece of my knowledge to your lips so I can melt inside of you and sing.